Tested is sponsored by Duke Health, home of the Pandemic Response Network, helping communities stay safe and connected during the COVID-19 pandemic by partnering with local school, business, and faith-based organizations to launch COVID-19 system support programs in their own communities. Learn more at pandemicresponsenetwork.org.
I'm Leonida Inge. This is Tested from WUNC, a look at what the day's challenges tell us about where we are, what we believe, and who we want to be in North Carolina and the South. Today, who gets to be an American? This pandemic has taken a toll on many Americans, but it's been a different kind of painful for those who want to be American citizens but can't. For one thing, the path to becoming a United States citizen dried up for a while when states started to lock down, helping to create a naturalization backlog. Several media outlets report that more than 300,000 people were stuck in this backlog, likely squashing their chances at a major benefit of citizenship, and that's casting a vote in the most recent presidential election. Yes, President Donald Trump and his administration is getting a lot of the blame. Trump's anti-immigration rhetoric over the past few years spurred a big rush to citizenship. Too much for U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services to handle. In some places, it was taking longer than a year for applications to be processed. And then the coronavirus pandemic hit, stopping everything in its tracks. That's why it was so surprising when Trump used his position and power, some say unlawfully, to host a naturalization ceremony for 5 people, which aired during the Republican National Convention back in August.
Acting Secretary Wolf, I present to you 5 candidates for naturalization representing 5 countries.
On behalf of everyone here today, I'd like to express my gratitude to you, Mr. President, for hosting this naturalization ceremony here at the White House. To our candidates, it is my honor to administer the oath of allegiance and welcome you as our fellow citizens. Candidates for naturalization, please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I hereby declare
an oath
that I absolutely and entirely.
The 5 new U.S. citizens from Ghana, Lebanon, Bolivia, Sudan, and India smiled and waved American flags.
You've earned the most prized, treasured, cherished, and priceless possession anywhere in the world. It's called American citizenship. There is no higher honor and no greater privilege, and it's an honor for me to be your president. Thank you very much.
Now, that was special, especially since there are no big in-person naturalization ceremonies happening currently because of COVID. It's not easy getting to the finish line of citizenship. Most of the people who make it have already done the real hard part. They have become a lawful permanent resident and secured what's called a green card. But getting a green card has become harder for some people, even those the government brought to the U.S. as refugees. Professor Catherine Reynolds is director of Elon Law's Humanitarian Immigration Law Clinic. She says the Trump administration has set up numerous roadblocks to U.S. citizenship.
So what brought me to Greensboro at the beginning of 2016 at my previous organization was that I was charged with being the immigration coordinator because they had a USCIS-funded citizenship and integration grant. So the whole point of that grant is to help as many people become U.S. citizens, do these naturalization workshops, have civics and English classes. I think it was around August of 2017, that grant was renamed the Citizenship and Assimilation Grant. In February 2018, USCIS kind of took away the customer service provisions from its mission statement. I think these were all sending a message that we don't want you to naturalize. That was the takeaway I was getting from people that I spoke with who had the eligibility to become citizens. They were really concerned that there was something that the government was going to find, and instead of granting them citizenship, which they were incredibly eligible for some reason, find a way to, you know, rescind their green card or deport them.
I became a citizen December 2011, and the motivator for me was ahead of a presidential election.
Uliana Cabrales is the Mid-Atlantic director of the Naleo Education Fund, whose mission is to provide policies that advance Latino political engagement, like voting.
When I applied for citizenship, the Raleigh-Durham office was in existence. I applied and became a U.S. citizen 4 months later. So it was a speedy process. You know, obviously I speak English, and so the aspect of the English and civics test was not a big hurdle for me. Kind of crammed the night before through the questions and was ready to take that test. A story that I vividly remember, at that time I wasn't doing this work, is I showed up for my interview, sat to an older gentleman who, the minute I sat next to him, native Spanish speaker, reminded me of my father, right? He was extremely nervous about the test. Told me he had been studying for months in anticipation of his interview. And at that moment, as someone that hadn't been doing this work, it made me realize, wow, my path is very different. And there's a lot of folks that reach this point and are nervous, and there's big hurdles facing them, right? So something that I crammed the night before, for him, it had been months of studying. And so we were called separately into our interviews. And on the way out, I glanced around, right, hoping to see him. And he gave me a thumbs up, indicating that he had passed that test. And that's a story that stuck with me. And when I started to do this work, made me realize, you know, when folks make this decision to become a U.S. citizen, they come to the table with very different experiences, very different skill sets, and some with bigger hurdles and challenges ahead of them than others.
Wow, did that make you cry? It should have.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, thinking about it makes me, yeah.
Cabrales says there are all kinds of challenges to becoming an American citizen. First, it can cost a working family a lot of money, especially in legal services. And then there's a little civics test you have to take. And Cabrales says this year, that test has become harder.
We believe individuals that are eligible and ready to become U.S. citizens should take that step and should have, that route should not be filled with obstacles and barriers, right? Oftentimes, the biggest of those obstacles is the cost associated with applying for U.S. citizenship. Right now, in most cases, that's $725 out of pocket. So you can imagine if you have two, three folks applying from one household, that's a significant amount of money, and it takes time to save that up.
That's about 3 months' rent, I think. It sounds like that.
Exactly. And we know how hard it is, Lonita, for folks to come up with the rent money right now, right, during the pandemic. And so what it means, citizenship really feels like a luxury, right, when you're not able to keep your house or feed your family. I know as a young college student, when I became a lawful permanent resident, that's what kept me from applying to citizenship, right? I'm now doing this work and encouraging others. But as a young professional, it took me a while to gather up those funds. That was the main obstacle I faced when I wanted to become a U.S. citizen. This administration earlier this year proposed a significant increase in that fee. That's been halted by the courts, and we're happy to see that.
And that was going to be over $1,000, I hear, for that fee.
Yes, it was probably one of the biggest fee increases we've seen in naturalization in recent history. And if we talk about $725 already being a lot for folks, imagine over $1,000. Another obstacle that's also related to costs is that folks oftentimes feel like they need legal representation, right? And so the work we do at Naleo Educational Fund and the work many of our partner-based organizations do is making sure that folks that have simple cases receive that assistance at a very low cost or free of charge. a lot of that assistance is assistance we usually provide in person, right? I'm based in Raleigh, and we used to host events every other month in which we would have partner organizations open up their doors, attorneys come volunteer with us. Folks would come into the room with their paperwork and would walk out with an application that's ready to be mailed. You can imagine that because of social distancing, stay in the home orders, a lot of that work, I think the last event we hosted here in Raleigh was late February. We haven't been able to get to that. So we're doing our part to assist folks virtually, but it's a slow moving process, being able to, you know, obtain all the documents, explain to folks what the process is like. So that's the second piece that we're having to overcome. How do we continue to provide assistance or connect folks to individuals, attorneys that are willing to help free or low cost, given the pandemic? And then the third piece, the third barrier and obstacle is the civics test and the English language requirements. Not surprisingly, a lot of folks that are applying for U.S. citizenship are not, English is not their first language. And so depending on when they came to this country, whether they arrived knowing English or not, how old they are, that level of expertise, right, and knowledge varies greatly. And so as an organization, we've always advocated that both the English and civics test be as simple as possible, elementary school level, to truly make sure that many immigrants have access to becoming a U.S. citizen. And unfortunately, the administration has chosen to revise the civics test. The revised version has more questions, they're more broadly worded, and makes it harder for folks to pass the test.
I wonder if you can give us an example
yeah.
of a question or two, especially the ones you think are the ones that have been changed and probably made a little bit more difficult.
Yeah, so a simple one is, it used to be, there's a question about the 13 original states, right? North Carolina being one of those. And it used to be name three of those 13 original states. The new revised test asked for name five of those 13 original states. It might not seem like a big difference, right, to include two more states, but when we're having to learn 128 questions, right, and meeting and having an officer ask you these questions one-on-one, that's already an intimidating process. And so how do we justify that naming five has more validity or it's more important than simply naming three? Some of the questions now are more broader, and so it's less concrete answers, which you can imagine makes it harder. An example of that is a new question that says, name one example of an American innovation. So that's a very broad question, and it also ignores the reality that accomplishments are rarely, if ever, achieved solely by one person or one country, right? Those are just two quick examples of things that we know are going to make it harder for folks to pass the test.
Yeah, it makes me think, was the traffic light an American innovation? Now I'm thinking, can I pass this test, you know?
Exactly. And to your point, whether folks that are born in this country, right, would be able to even pass this test is a huge component of this.
One group of people living in America who continue to fight for their rightful place in this country are our Dreamers. They entered the United States as minors, but are able to gain conditional residency through DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. The Trump administration tried to end the program, but the U.S. Supreme Court disagreed. Dreamers are again able to apply for DACA.
Yeah, so as a little bit of background, we know in 2012, then President Obama issued an executive order, right, that created this Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. And basically, it allowed individuals that had arrived at a young age in the United States, undocumented, to have a path towards working and remaining in this country without the fear of deportation. That program, when it was first instituted, was very successful. And folks came out of the shadows, right? Bravely came forward and applied because they recognized the importance of being able to remain in this country. In many cases probably felt more American than from their country of origin. And then also the program allowed them to be able to work, which we know is a huge piece, you know, as you age and have the option to attend college or have to work right out of high school. In 2017, we saw the current administration challenge it in court, the legality of it, because it was issued through an executive order as opposed through, you know, a law that was passed by Congress. The program was pretty much halted until earlier this year. There was a Supreme Court ruling and then a federal court ruling out of New York that basically stated that the program should continue and that the arguments for canceling it were convoluted and not clear. So less on the legality of it, more on the arguments that were used to halt the program. In early December, so earlier this week, we found out that USCIS has opened that program back up after judge ruled that the program needed to be restored to its original guidelines. So that was good news we got in early December, working actively with many of our partner organizations to make sure that the information gets out there. The program has been opened up again, so it allows individuals that have never had DACA to apply for it. It also allows folks to renew DACA and request what's known as an advanced parole, which is a permit that allows for overseas travel of DACA recipients.
Is it true to say that DACA is supposed to be a path to citizenship, like at least starting off the process for a lot of people?
The DACA program does not offer a path to citizenship. Folks, once they apply, receive that work authorization, have the chance to apply for permitted travel, but there's no path for folks to apply for citizenship. And that's one of the big issues with the DACA program. And that's why we need Congress to act. Because individuals that live in this country, work, arrived at a young age, should have a path to citizenship.
Juliana Cabrales is the Mid-Atlantic Director of the NALEO Education Fund. Becoming a U.S. citizen is a big deal for people who want that status. And even in a pandemic, folks are going to find a way to celebrate that achievement. Remember Catherine Reynolds from Elon's Humanitarian Immigration Law Clinic? She says she made the best of it with a client who became a citizen this summer.
The COVID-19 pandemic oath ceremonies are completely void of pomp and circumstance. However, they are still joyful. People are still getting flags. They are still able to pose for pictures. They still get to stand in front of a beautiful backdrop while they take the oath. They've tried to make them, you know, still as special as they can. However, you know, the family members are waiting in the parking lot, maybe in the car, to see if they come out with an American flag and a certificate if they pass. The celebration happens in the parking lot. I myself was part of a dance party in the parking lot on a July morning this year. As I went in with a client and his two sons waited in the minivan, and we all had our masks on and were taking up like two parking spaces, socially distanced dancing, after I came out with their father and his certificate of naturalization.
That makes me think about what that moment means to so many. More in a moment.
There are things we're taught not to discuss in polite company, but by avoiding so-called impolite conversations, we're missing out on the chance to make important connections with each other. I'm Anita Rao, and I'm on a personal journey to uncover just what happens when we open ourselves up to talking about taboo topics that affect our bodies and our brains. Find out on Embodied, a new podcast about sex, relationships, and your health from North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
In 2008, more than 1 million people became naturalized U.S. citizens, a record. In 2016, 753,000 people went through the process. There were definitely policies in place in 2008 to allow for such large numbers, but if you chatted up someone at a naturalization oath ceremony back then, there was a good chance, they said, they applied for citizenship to make sure they could vote in what became a historic presidential election. That's when Barack Obama's name was on the ballot.
I hereby declare on oath.
This 2008 oath ceremony took place at the Citizenship and Immigration Office in Durham, North Carolina. I was there because my ex-husband, Mustafa Barry, of Senegal, West Africa, was finally becoming a U.S. citizen.
I feel happy that finally I get to choose some choices in this country.
Every corner of the room was packed, every seat taken. Our son, Jean-Christian Barry, was 11 years old at the time and demanded to interview his father as well.
Are you happy to know that you're now an American citizen?
Definitely. I'm quite happy.
How about the fact that now you can vote inside of this history-making election?
Put an extra to that, extra happy to be able to do that.
To make sure these new citizens got the chance to vote, large naturalization oath ceremonies were also held outside such confined offices, even in convention centers to accommodate the crowds. Remember crowds? The pandemic and COVID-19 has prevented such memorable experiences, but it's also up to our elected officials to get out of the kitchen and let our great melting pot cook on its own. That's it for this episode of Tested. I'm Leonida Inge. Our producers are Rebecca Martinez and Charlie Shelton Ormond. Lindsay Foster Thomas is the executive producer. Thanks for listening.